It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll get some advice on the best way to contribute to food pantries.
First, we woke up this morning to the news that fan favorite Bo Ryan, coach of the UW Badger men's basketball team, was retiring from coaching effective immediately. The 68-year-old Ryan had announced in June that this would be his last season as head coach. But much like another beloved figure in Wisconsin sports history, Ryan maybe was given hints, indications, making people think he'd stick around a while longer.
So maybe that's why this morning's announcement comes as sort of a surprise to Badger fans. Assistant Greg Gard now takes the reins of the team, but he'll have some pretty big shoes to fill. So how did Ryan change the game of basketball at UW, and what kind of legacy does he leave behind?
Myron Metcalf is here with us now to look at these questions. He's a staff writer at ESPN where he covers college basketball. Myron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we knew this was coming. Fans in particular knew this, but maybe not right ready for it to happen today. What was your reaction when you heard that Bo Ryan was retiring?
I wasn't surprised. I mean, I figured it would happen at some point during the season, potentially. After he made the announcement before the year, I just thought it was a matter of when, and there was some speculation. You know, it could come sooner rather than later, and his explanation both on the timing, just feeling right, and wanting to give Greg Gard an opportunity to kind of audition for the job. It all makes sense. So I really, it was odd that it happened on a Tuesday night after sort of a game that didn't mean much, but it's not surprising that he left mid-season. I mean, I think this was probably how he was thinking as he kind of went back and forth over the last couple of months.
You know, you'd think, why not go out after last season at a peak, you know, to the finals, really a great, exciting year for the team. This year, seen as more of a rebuilding year, they're not going to be what they were last year. A lot of people thought, hey, maybe it would have made sense to go out then before this season.
Yeah, it's always hard. You know, I mean, exits are hard in any profession. But I think when it comes to coaching and the connection that Bo has to some of those young men, you know, when is the right time? So I'm sure he considered it, and that's what he said before the season, that, you know, he thought about whether or not to leave right after the Final Four run, but he came back. And I think a part of him coming back was Greg Garden giving him a shot. But I also just think he, in the last couple of years, has really thought about how much longer he'd stick around. And, you know, I did a story on him a couple of years ago, actually last year, and I went to Madison, hung out with him for a while. And I think after losing his father, that perhaps changed his perspective on, you know, how limited our time is and how important it is to spend that time with people you care about. He's got grandchildren now who are getting a lot older. His kids, I think he wants to do more beyond basketball, and I think that's why he left when he did.
Well, let's look back on his Wisconsin basketball career. Before UW-Madison, first of all, he had a lot of success in Milwaukee, UW-Milwaukee, and UW-Platteville, right?
Yeah, he was a superstar at Platteville, 4 national championships. That's kind of what started everything. When you talk to the folks who played for him at Platteville, and they tell you he's the same guy today that he was then. And then he goes to UW-Milwaukee and makes his way to Wisconsin. And I grew up in Wisconsin, and obviously when you think of the University of Wisconsin's athletic department, growing up in the 90s, in the 80s, you thought of football. You know, you thought of Ron Day. You thought of some of the other talented players that the football team produced. So Bo was the first guy, I think. Obviously Dick Bennett started this process, but the first guy who made people think about Wisconsin nationally as a basketball program. That's not easy to do. I mean, he wasn't doing it with a bunch of McDonald's All-Americans, although he had some. He was doing it with a lot of gritty kids, blue-collar kids who developed and evolved into big-time talent. So I think certainly Bo Ryan is looked at as somewhat of a legend in this game, what he did for Wisconsin to put them on the map, and I think that's why you have so many people talking about the fact that he's gone, because he definitely was one of the best.
Talking to Myron Metcalf, staff writer at ESPN, talking about Bo Ryan's retirement as of right now. He's out effective immediately as coach of the UW basketball team. So, yeah, you said this was not a glamour place for basketball recruits. How did he change things? How did he get improve recruiting? And then, as you said, taking maybe these people who were not the high-profile players, turning them into stars.
I really think Bo has a unique eye for kind of what a player will be. It's easier, I think, when you're at Arizona and Kentucky and you're looking at these 6'10" trees and, you know, they have 5 stars behind their names. It's easier, I think, to look at those guys and say, okay, he'll be a good player. It's much harder when you're dealing with 2- and 3-star prospects and you're trying to figure out, okay, not who they are now, but who will they be in 2 to 3 years? And Bo had a unique gift, I think, in his ability to look at a player and know what they would become 3 or 4 years down the line. You look at a Trayvon Jackson. Trayvon Jackson, in my opinion, doesn't become a starter for another Power 5 team, but he was a starter for this Wisconsin team. Frank Kaminsky goes on to win the Wooden Award, goes to the NBA. But when people saw him in high school, no one knew what to make of him. And certainly people didn't think that he would be the player that he became. So Bo had a great eye for kind of what to expect and how these players would develop. And then he also just had a way of making them all kind of buy into the Wisconsin culture, if you will. He had a way of kind of getting these guys to play together. And that's not as simple as it seems when you're dealing with a bunch of teenagers. So the chemistry, developing talent, Bo just had a way of putting it all together.
Well, talk about his coaching personality. This was not a, you know, Bobby Knight hurling chairs onto the arena. What was he like compared to, you know, what else is out there around the country?
I mean, he didn't hurl chairs, but he went at a number of referees. I mean, you know, Bo didn't bite his tongue in games. He was always sticking up for his players. I don't think Bo ever saw a foul call that he approved of, that he agreed with. So, but he was, I think, a guy who really instilled a system and a culture, and he just expected his players to follow it. I mean, Wisconsin, it really wasn't rocket science for those guys. If you turn the ball over with Bo, you're coming out of the game. Players will tell you. They don't look to the coach and go, man, give me another shot, give me some more time. They just walk to the sideline because they know they're coming out of the game. Bo doesn't have to yell. He doesn't have to scream. They understand that there's a process and there's an expectation, and if you don't follow it, then you're not going to play. And there are multiple players you can talk to over the years who will tell you that, who maybe thought they were better than they were, made some mistakes and didn't see as much playing time as they expected to. But that was just the culture of Wisconsin basketball. I went to a practice last year as part of a story I did about Bo Ryan, and I've never been to a practice, and I go to practices all over America, I've never been to a practice that quiet. I mean, literally you could hear a pin drop. They weren't yelling and screaming at one another. The coaches weren't barking at players. It was just such, like, almost a business meeting, so routine. Everyone knew what to do within that practice session because that's what Bo expected. Discipline, you guys are young men. You should know what to do by now and get out there and do it. And you don't have to scream and yell and, you know, grab people's uniforms to make them respond.
And I'll be up front with you, Myron. I'm a casual college basketball fan. We'll watch occasionally. But last year, the tournament run, I was like a lot of people around the state, and I got sucked in, and it was an exciting team to watch, a lot of fun watching him go that far into the tournament. What happened last year? How did it all come together like it did under Bo Ryan?
Well, it always helps when you have two first-round picks in the NBA draft, and they have Frank Kaminsky and Sam Decker and Duane Dukin, who's now at the Sacramento Kings. So that team actually had three NBA guys, Nigel Hayes, could be a pro in the future, as well as Bronson Koenig. So, I mean, the first way it happened is because they had the talent to compete with the best teams in America. And I think also just the experience that they had, the fact that Sam Decker and Frank Kaminsky were guys who'd been there before, and they really had guys around them who respected them. Again, it's a cliche in sports, but people, chemistry really, really matters. And it matters most when you get to the final stages of competition. Everybody's together when you're winning early in the season, right? I mean, you see a football team that's 3-0. You see a basketball team that's 7-0. Everybody's on the same page. It gets a lot harder, especially in college basketball, with the young people when you get to January and you get to February and people are struggling and people are missing shots and guys aren't getting the minutes that they expect. How do you keep all that together? And that was really an art form, if you will, I think, for Bo Ryan. That those players, I've been in the locker room, those batters really genuinely liked one another. And I think clearly you could see that in how they performed on the court.
What kind of legacy do you think Bo Ryan leaves behind at Wisconsin?
The greatest coach in Wisconsin history. I mean, I think that obviously is a big part of it, one of the best coaches to ever do it. One of the most versatile coaches. I mean, you can't ignore what he did at the Division III level with Platteville. So I think he leaves as a legend, man. At some point, there will be a statue, I'm sure, and I think people will look back and go, you know, wow, how impressive was that? And really, when you're in it, it's hard to see. I think it'll take some time, and then people will look back and go, wow, this guy went to multiple Final Fours, four Big Ten championships, never missed the NCAA tournament. I think in the future, people will look back and see how difficult it is to actually do what Bo Ryan did in his 14-plus years.
We'll leave it there. Myron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Brad.
That's Myron Metcalf, staff writer at ESPN. He covers college basketball, and he joined us to talk about the retirement, effective immediately, of UW men's basketball head coach Bo Ryan.
Many people help others during the holiday giving season, and food pantries see a lot of donations this time of year.
But sometimes what to give and what not to give can be just as important as giving itself. So we asked Amber Canto, state coordinator for the Wisconsin Nutrition Education Program, to join us with some tips on how and what to donate. Amber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be here.
So first, tell us, how many food banks and pantries do we have around Wisconsin?
Well, we actually don't have a perfect list of the number of food pantries all throughout the state. So the best list we use comes from food pantries that are affiliated with our federal commodities program or the Emergency Food Assistance Program. And we're looking at over 250 individual food pantries across the state. And then on top of that, many of those pantries are affiliated with food banks. And we have roughly six or seven either nationally affiliated or independent food banks in the state.
Now, you use food banks and food pantries as different terms. I use them interchangeably. I've heard of food shelves, they call them in other states. What's the difference between a bank, a food bank, and a food pantry?
Yeah, so they are actually different entities, and many people do use them interchangeably, so you're not alone. Food banks, we often use that term to refer to a larger operation that will pool their resources to purchase product or receive donations at a greater scale. And then the food banks provide those food items to individual food pantries that may be affiliated with or a member of the food bank. So we actually have a national food bank association, which is referred to as Feeding America. We have a Feeding Wisconsin, the local affiliate of that chapter. And we also have some independent food banks in the state, such as Hunger Task Force, if you're in the Milwaukee area. Food pantries are smaller in scale, and you know, you might be familiar with them as the closet or the room in your church. In some cases, we see them in local nonprofits or community action program agencies. Some food pantries are even housed in schools. So it really just depends on the host agency, where they're at, and how you'll see them.
So for these organizations providing food, what do they really need? What kinds of foods do they tend to want the rest of us to give?
Well, high quality and high integrity packages are always preferred. So when you look at the types of food to donate, you know, product dating is one of those gray areas or areas of concern, and increasingly we're seeing product dates that are on the actual products, and it can cause some confusion. So I'll break them down for you just to give a better sense of the what to donate or what not to donate. Some items you'll see a quality or a pack date, and that's often designated by the words better if used by. And what these dates really mean is an indication of the quality date after which the food will begin to lose flavor, and it might even develop an off flavor. But generally speaking, foods that are well within these dates are preferred by our food pantry partners. We also see products that have expiration dates, and it might include, you know, the specific words of expires after X or Y date, and or do not use after X or Y date. And these might be on things like yeast or baking powder, cake mixes. And we definitely want to encourage the donation of products that are within their expiration date. So if the date has passed, it's probably better to not donate that forward. We also have products that are designated with a pull date. And so this will be, and the example would be a sell-by X or Y date. And we often see these on perishable items, milk, yogurt, cottage cheese, eggs, etc. And generally speaking, it's probably safest to donate non-perishable food items, so things that don't have a pull-by date. But if you do donate an item that has a pull-by date, generally we encourage that the products be donated, again, well within the date. We also like to see the donation of high-quality products from a nutritious standpoint. And when we talk about perishable items, we often think items that, you know, or perhaps high in salt or added sugars, heavily processed. But there's lots of good, healthy options that one could donate to a food pantry that falls within that non-perishable lens, such as canned vegetables, perhaps those without added salt, fruits that are in 100% juice or unsweetened applesauce. Also, lots of high-quality canned meats, fish, chicken, beef, tuna, etc. All of those items are heavily welcomed by food pantries now.
Amber, I want to jump in and ask, is it worth a call to the local food pantry? Do they mind if people call and say, hey, what do you need there right now?
Yeah, it's a great point. Food pantries may have specific needs, and it's always worth giving a call to the food pantry and say, what do you need right now? Are you short in one thing or another? And they can encourage the donation of a product that really helps fill their need or the pantry client preferences.
I've heard from people at food pantries in the past, food donations, lovely. We're not going to turn them away. But money donations actually can make a big difference. We often can get things, the food pantries, can get things cheaper than the general public. So cash donations, not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea at all.
So you mentioned 250-plus organizations around the state. Is there a good way for listeners to find the nearest one in their area, the one that might need their help in their own backyard?
Sure. There's a couple of different ways that one might go about finding a local food pantry. I would say the most comprehensive list that's accessible across the state would be by calling 211. So from your phone, 211, or you could look online, 211 Wisconsin. And they've compiled a variety of information of resources in communities and could refer individuals back to a local food pantry. You could also check the Feeding America website and look at affiliate food pantries for the various food banks in the state, or even contact Hunger Task Force, which again is perhaps the largest affiliate of from an independent food bank perspective in the Milwaukee area.
Amber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem.
That's Amber Canto. She's the state coordinator for Wisconsin Nutrition Education, talking about how to donate to your local food pantry. The nuclear family with two parents and a couple of kids is not the norm anymore, less and less so over time, in fact. One big trend that's replaced it, many more people are living alone.
But that's not the whole story. Recent statistics find more adults living in multi-generational families, with young women living with their parents in numbers not seen since the 1940s. Senior citizens are finding roommates. Families and individuals are joining co-housing projects, and living alone can mean a lot of different things for different people who are finding ways to stay connected in and out of their homes.
Our next guest digs into these trends. She traveled around the country to meet people and find out what home means to them. Bella DiPaolo is a project scientist in psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's the author of How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century. Bella, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the people who are living alone. You found that living alone actually means a lot of different things depending on who you're talking to. As you went around the country, what were some of the different approaches you saw to life alone?
Yes, well, people who count as living alone by the Census Bureau those numbers have increased tremendously. But some people who are living alone actually are part of a bigger community. So they might be, as you mentioned in your introduction, part of a co-housing community where everybody has their own place, but they also share a common house where they might get together for meetings or meals occasionally. So that's one very organized version. Or sometimes people come up with kind of ad hoc ways of being alone and together, such as sharing a duplex or creating some other kind of situation where you are alone and you have your own place, but you have friends right nearby, maybe in the same building or on the same block or in the same city, and maybe you've even moved to a certain place together to be with people you know and care about, but you still want a place of your own.
When we talk about living alone, how much of that is by choice and how much is economic necessity?
Well, the more people have economic freedom, the more resources they have financially, the more likely they are to choose to live alone. So it's something that people get to choose because they have the resources to do so. But even people who really could live by themselves in a really nice place sometimes don't want that. They either want to live with other people or they want to live close to other people so that they have that mix of time alone and time together, privacy, autonomy, but also connection and togetherness.
I think sometimes when you see the stats about the trends from people living in nuclear families to living alone, some people see a synonym between living alone and being lonely. Sounds like that's not the case.
You're so right. That is one of the biggest misconceptions about people who live alone and one of the biggest misconceptions about people who are single. You know, we even use alone as a synonym. It's actually a defining characteristic of being single. And yet, what an overwhelming amount of new research is showing is that single people and people who live alone are actually more connected to other people than people who are married are. So they have more connections to, spend more time with, exchange more help with their friends, their neighbors, their siblings, their parents. They are more likely to contribute to the life of the city, so they take more classes, they get involved in more civic activities, they go out to restaurants more. So really, you know, we used to think of the nuclear family as the social glue that held our community and our society together. But it turns out when you look at the actual data from systematic research, it's single people and people who live alone who are doing that.
So what's going on with people in nuclear families? Are they just sitting at home staring at each other?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I'm an anecdote. Yeah, I'm a homebody, you know.
Yes, there are these great longitudinal studies that follow the exact same people over time and look at what their lives are like when they're single and then how they change when they get married. And what they find is that people become, on the average, obviously not every single person, but on the average, people become more insular once they get married. They pay less attention to their friends. They pay less attention to their siblings. They have less contact with their parents. And it's all about, like you said, looking at each other.
That's not a very rosy picture.
I'm cool with it. That's pretty much my life, yeah. We're talking to Bella DiPaolo. She's a project scientist in psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She's the author of How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century, talking about trends in what we call home, what we call family. Living alone is one of them. And Bella, multi-generational families. We mentioned research is from, I think, the Pew Research Center, finding a lot of young women are living with their parents now more than any other time since, we're talking the 1940s here. So what's up? Multi-generational families.
Well, part of it was the recession. So people moved in together because they couldn't afford to live on their own. But a very interesting, more recent Pew report came out showing that even after the most recent recession ended, the younger generation was still living with their parents. They hadn't moved out. And in fact, there was a slight increase. And the Pew researchers were baffled by that. They looked at all these different explanations. None of them accounted for the data. But what I think they missed is the interpersonal one, the psychological one. Young adults and their parents are very different today than young adults in their relationship with their parents were a generation or two ago. Namely, today's young adults and their parents actually like each other. They have more in common. You know, it's not like the days of the 60s and 70s when the younger adults were dressing and thinking and acting and liking music that their parents couldn't fathom. And they really, the two generations looked at each other like utter aliens. And it's just not true anymore. And so, in general, again, it's not true for everyone, but in general, the young adults who live with their parents find that, yes, it's good financially, but they also like the experience. And their parents, in systematic surveys, say that they also like having their young adult kids there. And in fact, they like it as much as parents whose kids have left the nest like their living situation.
So wait, both of those things are equally appreciated? kids out of the nest and kids back in the nest?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Huh.
It is especially amazing because there's been so much bad mouthing of this trend, you know, saying the parents are helicopter parents who are ruining their children and the children are Generation Stockton. You know, all those bad things that people come up with that make these adults, young adults and their parents seem awful. And, you know, those are opinions. But when you look at the actual research, it's not like that. You know, which is not to say that there aren't bad permutations of this. And of course there are. But on the average, it works out well.
Well, that's the younger generations. Let's move to the older generations now. I've seen some things. This is getting more anecdotal. Maybe you can tell us if this is real or not. Like AARP has talked about this. Seniors are more and more seeking roommates. So these are seniors who may be living independently at home, not in a looking for a home setting or anything like that. But they want the Golden Girls scenario, I guess.
Yes. I did find some of that in my research, too, where they come together and live together and share all the joys that were illustrated in the Golden Girls TV series. And again, it's good financially. You know, if you're on a fixed income or a limited budget for whatever reason, it helps to share all these expenses rather than have them all on your own. But, and of course, you can live in a nicer neighborhood maybe than you could if you were living on your own and paying for everything by yourself. But on top of that, there's the companionship. So that part of it is really attractive. And the sharing of, you know, how is your day, the kind of everyday interactions where you're sharing your life, not just a house. And also getting help with all the chores and so forth that need to be done. If you have several housemates, then each of the different housemates can choose to do what they mind the least, and everybody has less to do in total than they would if they were managing the whole household on their own.
I'm curious about the age group of the seniors that we're talking about here, if there's a concentration in a particular decade, and also how widespread this is. We've been hearing about this, but I haven't come across anyone personally doing it. It seems a fascinating thing, but how widespread is it?
It is increasing. It's not a huge number, but if you look at, for example, households comprised of people who are not related, in 1940, I think it was 1%, and now it's more than 6%. So it's a huge increase percentage-wise, but it's still not a huge number of people who are actually doing this. And that was for overall, not just for seniors. I do think it's something that's increasing, and you see different versions of it from people doing it on their own, just knowing people or trying to find people. And then there are more systematic resources out there. There's something called Golden Girls Homes that helps people find roommates. There's a National Shared Housing Resource Center that was actually started by Maggie Kuhn, the famous, aging activist. So I do think that it's something that's likely to catch on.
Talking to Bella DiPaolo, she's the author of the book How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century. We're talking about what makes a home these days in the United States with more people living alone, some other people finding new ways to create a household and co-housing with roommates or living with their families.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you live alone? And if so, was it a conscious decision or did it just kind of work out that way? Do you live with your parents or maybe with your adult children or in co-housing or with roommates? Call and tell us the pros and the cons at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the way we live in the United States with a growing trend toward living alone. Many people are trying new ways also of living together. Our guest is Bella DiPaolo, author of How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Maybe share your experience. Do you live alone? Is that lonely or do you feel more connected than maybe your coupled up peers? Do you have roommates, live in co-housing, a multi-generational household? Are you in a Golden Girls scenario? Maybe a senior living with other seniors to share companionship and the bills? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. Brad is on the line in Glendale. Brad, hi.
Yes. I teach college students, and so I know that you mentioned that a lot of students or a lot of people in their 20s are living with their parents by choice, even though the recession is over. But I also know from talking with my students their financial struggles, and that a lot of them simply couldn't afford an apartment, much less a house. And so a lot of them are still living with their parents, still out of financial necessity. So the recession's over, but they're not necessarily getting the high-paying jobs that can allow $800, $1,200 a month rent.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. So, Bella, still, even after the recession, financial reasons, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad arrangement, you were saying.
Right, totally. If the parents and their kids enjoy each other's company and don't get on each other's nerves and help each other out, it can be a great arrangement. And, it can be especially good for people in this economy where so much of it is putting together what you can do and finding work that works for you and not having this steady income in a corporation that pays a role. So I think it's good to have a financial head start that you can create by living with your parents.
Now, one interesting thing about this trend seems to be the spaces that are getting purposed for these new ways of living. I'm hearing about, you're writing about abandoned office buildings and newly constructed houses, but with maybe five or six master suites and a big common area. This must be a change.
Oh, it is. And it's happening across the whole age range. So with younger people, you see this trend toward what they sometimes call apartments or tiny apartments that are in a building that also has a lot of shared space so that people have their tiny little space, but they also have space where they can get together to barbecue or meet or share meals or have other entertainment. And then you have all these buildings that are getting renovated in ways that allow each person to have their own space, maybe their own apartment, and yet there is a certain companionship about it because they're rebuilt in a way that caters to the desire for togetherness that people have as well as their desire for their own privacy.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Kim on the line in Milwaukee. Kim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Kim?
Oh, I just wanted to talk about, well, when I was in college, I always had roommates, and I found that I really liked having roommates, and at this point in my life, my boyfriend and I live together, and we definitely had the means to get our own place, but we don't want to. We like having roommates, and it's been kind of a point of contention between me and, like, a lot of baby boomers. Just, they don't get it, like, you know what I mean? Like, our parents just don't understand why I want to keep having my roommate.
And sure, and Kim, before we let you go, can I ask how old you are now?
I'm 28.
28. And so, yeah, are we adjusting our cultural expectations now? The baby boomer, she's saying, what are you doing still living with roommates? You're 28. People might say that about somebody living with their parents, and there's a stigma there. Are we adjusting our culture to match the reality? Bella.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were still talking to her. Yes, our cultural perceptions are always lagging behind the way we live. So the way we actually choose to live just runs ahead, and we do what we find is works best for us, like the example that your caller just said. And yet, you tell somebody else about it, and they're like, what? Are you kidding me? And, it goes both in both directions. She just described being part of a couple, but wanting to live with other people as well, which I also found in my research. But then you have the exact opposite extreme, where people who are part of committed couples, maybe they're married, maybe they're even married with kids, decide to live in places of their own, not because their jobs keep them apart or their educational pursuit keeps them apart, but because that's what they want. They want their own space. And it even has its own way of describing it, living apart together, L-A-T. Hmm. And that's growing, too. So I think what I found mostly is that everybody wants some combination of time alone and time together, but the ratios that they want are vastly different. And the of all these different ways of living that I looked at, only one way of living is becoming less popular, and that's nuclear family living.
The staring at each other model, yeah.
Yeah. If you were to knock on doors across the United States at random, you would be more likely to be met by a single person living alone than a family of mom, dad, and the kids, which is really amazing when you think of just how commonplace nuclear family living was in the middle of the last century.
Well, I want to get to one more caller, but first I just want to ask you very quickly, is this happening everywhere, these kinds of new models, or is this something in my mind this just happens in New York City, or it really just happens in San Francisco or Los Angeles? Does it happen in Wisconsin?
You know, I think, yes, it does happen in the middle of the country. Co-housing communities can be found there, and in Michigan, I know there are a number of them. There are more on the coast, that's true. But there's a lot going on in the middle of the country, too. Some of the families I interviewed, are some of the people I interviewed were in Minnesota and Chicago. So, yeah, I found people innovating everywhere.
Let's bring on Amanda in Richfield now. Amanda, hi.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to describe my unique situation. My husband and I bought a large farmhouse 2 years ago. We're 28. And because of student loan debt, two of my sisters and one of their boyfriends also have moved in. We joke that it's the commune, and all of our friends and family members make fun of us. But really, it works out really well. We're all on different shifts. We rarely see each other. We have someone to take care of our pets when we're gone, and it just really works out well for us.
Amanda, thanks a lot for telling us about that. And Bella, I think that, you know, that might sound like a pitch for a sitcom in some situations, but they're, it sounds like they're making it work, and a lot of people are doing their own thing and coming up with solutions they're happy with.
They are. It's very impressive. People are being so innovative and creating the lives that work for them.
And what trends are you going to be watching for in the coming years? Where do you expect to see growth areas of some of this new stuff we're talking about?
You know, I think that people who are older, seniors, are really on the cutting edge of this because, you know, they really saw what happened in the generations before them and say, I am not ending up in an institution. And, of course, young adults, because they're staying single longer than ever before and sometimes staying single for life, they're going to be innovators, too. But really, it's across the age spectrum.
Well, Bella, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun. Hope we can talk to you again.
Thank you. Okay.
That was Bella DiPaolo. She's a project scientist in psychology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of the book How We Live Now, Redefining Home and Family in the 21st Century. Still time to share how you are living in the 21st century. Are you living alone? Are you with a nuclear family, one of the dying out breed, it sounds like? Do you have a unique roommate or family situation? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us about it there. Love to hear your stories and how you are fitting into this changing landscape of the way we live. Again, share your story. And by the way, see an article by Bella at the Central Time Facebook page. I'll look forward to what you have to say there.
And it seems like maybe part of this is nuclear families need to get out and do more stuff. It doesn't sound very attractive when you're listening that they sit at home, basically.
No, it's awesome. I've turned into such a homebody, and I love it.
We're both nuclear families, and I, too, like sitting in front of the hearth.
But you get out more than I do.
Well, yeah, I get out.
But I mean, there are like biblical hermits who got out more than I do. Let's be fair about that.
So. Well, you know, you have a busy job. We'll cut you some slack. So, yeah, let's see what people can do to make that a little more exciting.